welcome to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. Today, we're going to be talking about health, emotional, and developmental issues common to children adopted from abroad. We'll be talking with Dr. Dana Johnson. He is a professor of pediatrics and one of the founders of the Adoption Medicine Clinic at the University of Minnesota. He is also the parent to two birth daughters and an adopted son from India. Welcome, Dr. Johnson, to Creating a Family. Thank you so much for talking with us today about what is a very important topic.
Well, it's delightful to be here with you, Dawn.
All right. So we know that children who are adopted internationally come with a host of health, emotional, and developmental issues that we want parents to be aware of before they complete the adoption so that they know what they're getting into and also know that they will be prepared to be the best parent for this child. So we're going to start with talking about the general process for intercountry or international adoption. And I'm just going to walk through some of the basics that people need to, prospective adoptive parents need to know about. The first step is to choose a U.S. accredited or approved adoption service provider. And the way you would do that is go to the website for the Intercountry Adoption Accreditation and Maintenance Entity. It's the abbreviation is IAAME, and people call it IAMI. And you would go to their website, which is IAAME.net, and they have a list of accredited or approved adoption service providers. Then you would apply to the USCIS to be found eligible to adopt. Then, ultimately, this is a quick perusal, but then you would be matched with a child by the authorities in the country from which you are adopting. Then you would apply to USCIS for a child to be found eligible to immigrate to the United States and receive a U.S. agreement to proceed with the adoption. Then the next step is you would go, almost always you travel to the country, you would go and adopt the child in their country of origin. You would obtain a U.S. immigration visa for your child and then bring your child home. Now, let me pause and mention that each country has a different process. What I just gave you was a general overview. And the other thing that you need to know is this is something unique about intercountry adoption. You have to meet the legal requirements of the country that your child was born in, the U.S. government, and your state. To get more specific information on the process for the country you're considering, the best place to go to, well, first of all, your agency, get information from your agency. But you could also go to the State Department website, travel.state.gov, and click on Intercountry Adoption. And then you can get specific information. If you don't remember travel.state.gov, you can always use your search browser and just use the term State Department International Adoption to find the website. Then once there, you're going to click on the country information section and you can get specific information about the process in your country. And I should also mention that if you have problems along the way and you need to file complaints against your agency, if you have problems, you can do that at the Intercountry Adoption Accreditation and Maintenance Entity website. That is IAAME.net. All right. So that's the general process that you would go through. So now let's talk about some of the general characteristics and needs of the kids who are available for adoption from abroad. Dr. Johnson, you have been involved in international adoption probably just about longer than any doctor, really. So what are you seeing now about the general characteristics and needs of kids who are waiting to be adopted?
Well, Don, when I began in adoption medicine and around the time that I adopted my son, most of the kids that were available for adoption from abroad were very young, and they were generally in pretty good health. We've seen that change dramatically over the last 35 years. And most of the kids that are available now for adoption are children with special needs, and they're children that are older. And the reason for that is that adoption has really taken off in most of the sending countries so that younger, healthier infants are adopted in their country of origin. And the ones that are difficult to place internationally are the ones that have disabilities or significant medical problems or have been within institutional or other types of care for a long period of time.
So the factors that lead children to be in state care and need adoptive families are special needs and age, Are those the primary factors that you see that lead children to be placed now?
Well, I think that if you look throughout the world, the vast majority of kids who are within institutional care or waiting for placement in adoptive families are children who have been placed in care because of poverty. Most of them have one parent. Very few are actual double orphans or have lost both their mother and father. But being a single parent in many countries puts tremendous financial obligations on individuals, and they often can't take care of their children and place them within state care. I mentioned disabilities. There's also the social stigma of single-parent pregnancy, which is also coupled with financial problems. And we have kids from natural disasters or from parental incapacity, such as mental illness, or parents being placed in jail because of legal problems or mental health issues. Very few are actually placed because of abuse, although many have experienced abuse. But throughout the world, poverty is really the motivating factor for kids to be in care.
So what are the most frequent medical or psychological problems that you see now in children who are brought to you for evaluation after adoption?
Well, they're the problems that we see due to the nature and economic status of the country involved. So because of poverty, we see problems with growth. We also see problems with infectious diseases, especially intestinal parasites, in countries that don't have higher standards of care. But we also see a number of, or a great variety of disabling conditions that cause parents to abandon their children to state care. And these can vary from severe cardiac problems, gastrointestinal, just about any organ system can be involved.
So another factor that we sometimes see, not infrequently see, is malnutrition. How does malnutrition affect children? And does it depend on the age at which they are malnourished?
Well, malnutrition can be devastating for kids, particularly when very young children are malnourished. During the early years of life, when brain growth occurs, or the majority of brain growth occurs, not having enough food to eat really stunts not only physical growth, but also brain growth as well. And that growth inhibition can be permanent in terms of effects on the central nervous system and in terms of development. As kids get older and growth slows down and brain growth is not going through that tremendous surge that we see in infancy, the effects are less, but they still could be significant. So malnutrition is never good for kids, which is why the World Health Organization and UNICEF pay so much attention to making sure kids are well-nourished.
And what about malnourishment in pregnancy? A pregnant woman who doesn't have an adequate diet, how does that impact the fetus and then the baby?
Well, babies are pretty good parasites, so they will often take from the mother what they need, actually making her health a little bit worse. But in severe cases where we have very bad maternal malnutrition, we see significant growth restriction in the infants, and that can affect long-term linear growth. So these kids are shorter. It can affect cognitive development because their brain growth is not as good. It can also lead to additional problems like, for instance, early puberty in kids who've sustained intrauterine growth restriction because of maternal malnutrition.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite of what you might think.
Right.
You would think that they would be postponed entering puberty. All right, now let's talk about environmental toxins. We know that there are different environmental laws. There are different standards for what cookware and all sorts of environmental pollutants and toxins. So I want to talk about what are some of the common environmental toxins you're currently seeing. And let's talk about, I'm going to go through some of the primary placing countries to the United States. All right, so what are some of the environmental toxins that you know of or see in, say, China?
Well, in China, and this actually is probably the most common one that we know of around the world, we for a while saw a very high incidence of lead toxicity in kids. In countries with poor environmental records, things can get into the environment fairly easily, and lead is certainly one of the most common contaminants that we see in the environment. We're seeing less of it than we used to since leaded gasoline has been phased out around the world, but it's still a significant issue, and we always check for lead toxicity in kids.
How does lead affect a child?
Well, there are a couple things that happen. One is that development is impaired. Lead can be toxic to the central nervous system, so that brain growth is altered, brain development is changed, and these kids can wind up with a lower IQ if they have significant toxicity. They can also develop anemias and other symptoms if lead levels are very, very high. But it's the developmental delay that is the most significant and the longest lasting.
All right, then India is another one of the top placing countries. What are some environmental toxins? Is lead a continued issue there? And are there additional environmental toxins that parents should be aware of?
Well, lead is a continuing issue there. You know, one of the problems is that there are so many potential toxins that it's very difficult to decide what to check for. And to my knowledge, no one really has done a toxicologic survey of children coming from abroad that have been adopted into this country or European countries to see what might be present. But certainly, countries with high environmental standards, the risk is going to be low. The countries where very lax environmental standards are present, the possibility of insecticide pollution, other agents that get into the water or the food system, is always a possibility.
Anything additional that you would add for some of the other top countries, South Korea, Bulgaria, let's see, Colombia, Haiti, or certain African countries, anything that comes to mind from an environmental toxin standpoint that would be present there but not already discussed?
No, not that I know of, to be honest with you. But obviously, in countries like that, with poor environmental records, there is the possibility, although we're not exactly sure what specific things to look for.
All right. And for parents who are wanting more specific information and on the country that they're considering, the World Health Organization has some information. World Health Rankings would have some information. And you can also check with the World Food Program, which would have some information on malnutrition. All right. And here's a topic that is common in the United States as well, and that is the impact on children of maternal substance abuse. And let's make sure that we're talking about alcohol as well as drugs. I think so often we think of maternal substance abuse and we don't think of alcohol because it's at least in the U.S., is a legal substance, and across most of the world it is. So let's talk about how our fetuses and babies impacted by mom's consumption of alcohol or drugs during pregnancy.
Well, the consumption of these agents not only affects the baby directly, but also affects the mom in the sense of her ability to take care of herself, her ability to get prenatal care, her ability and desire to take care of herself during pregnancy, eat a good diet, etc. So the significant use of illicit and legal agents like alcohol can alter outcome in pregnancy in a number of different ways. Certainly mothers who are addicted and who parent their children for a period of time before relinquishing them to institutional care often provide a deprived environment for their child as well. So it's a multifactorial thing. But in terms of the actual effects of agents on children, for most of the illicit drugs that are used, such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, etc., there are two major areas of effects on the baby. One would be actual effects on the pregnancy itself. So, for instance, we know that mothers who use cocaine can often have spikes in blood pressure and can have effects on the placental circulation and often deliver babies prematurely. So that can be an effect of the drugs. But also there's the direct effect of the drug on the central nervous system of infants. And we are all aware of neonatal abstinence syndrome, where children are born addicted and have to come off of those drugs over the first weeks or months of life. And that affects their ability to function normally as an infant and to respond in a normal way and be able to be calmed and soothed by their caregivers. Of all the agents that mothers can use during pregnancy, the most devastating, though, is alcohol. And that clearly is the number one cause of preventable mental retardation and mental health problems that we are currently aware of. There's no safe amount of alcohol, and alcohol consumption varies tremendously around the world. We often think of Eastern Europe and alcohol consumption there as being very problematic, and that's true. But we're seeing much more alcohol use during pregnancy in Korea and other countries where westernized standards of living are permeating the culture so that it's now permissible for young women to drink. In fact, in Korea, it's looked at as a badge of honor to be able to drink as much as the men companions when you go out to a bar. So we're seeing more problems with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and fetal alcohol syndrome in many countries where we never used to see it.
Yeah, and there's not as much of a public awareness campaign in certain countries. South Korea, again, comes to mind about the dangers. We have been, you know, for the last, 20 years, it has been drummed into probably more, maybe 30 years. It's been a lot of public service announcements about the dangers of alcohol consumption. But other countries don't have that. So there's less social stigma and quite frankly, just less knowledge about the impact of maternal alcohol consumption. Let me mention two things. One, oftentimes, and this is the case with drug exposure, the opioids, the heroines, the meth, coke, things such as that, the impacts are such that very often parents don't see them until the child is in early school age because it's impacting higher level thinking and skills that come into effect then. So one of the things to consider if you are a parent who is adopting a child who may have been exposed to some of these drugs is to be aware of early intervention services and to be cognizant of your child and in the beginning and how they're doing academically and get them support early on. Another point is that we have many courses at Creating a Family that go into great detail on the topic of the impact of prenatal exposure on children. All right, so we've talked about, you've mentioned South Korea. Are there any other countries that come to mind that have a higher, when I say countries, I mean those that are placing internationally to the U.S., that have a higher incident of prenatal exposure?
Well, we see it in every country. It's probably, you know, alcohol use, Korea, Eastern Europe would be the more common countries, but we've seen it in kids from Ethiopia and South Africa and many places where you wouldn't necessarily think that alcohol use would be high among pregnant women. Mm-hmm. So I think it's universal around the world that risk exists. And the more you can find about the mother's history, the better off we are in terms of being able to integrate that into our evaluation of the child.
What about malnutrition? What are the countries that you see where malnutrition is more of a problem?
I think malnutrition is going to be directly related to the economic standard of each particular country. So it would be extremely unlikely to see a malnourished child coming from Korea, much more likely to see a malnourished child coming from, for instance, India.
Okay.
Africa, et cetera, would be a place where food insecurity is a major problem. And not only are mothers malnourished, but children often within institutional care settings where they don't have the resources to adequately feed their children are going to be malnourished as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. It's not just their home environment, but once they are in state care, malnutrition can also continue or even begin at that point. Well, we assume that mental health is fairly universal throughout the human population, but perhaps it's not. So are there countries that you see that are placing to the U.S. where you see a greater incident of emotional issues, or are emotional issues dependent on other factors that could be in any country?
Well, any child who spends any time within an institution is going to be at risk of a variety of emotional and behavioral disorders. So countries that use primarily institutional care settings rather than foster care are going to be, those problems are going to be more common. We also see, because you know, children with, in quotes, disabilities are being placed for inter-country adoption because they can't be placed domestically. We're going to see a skewing of the population of international adoptees as kids who are identified in their country of origin as having mental health issues. But I don't think there's a specific country where that's more common than other places.
You know, genetic abnormalities are something we get questions about. And again, I'm not sure that there I would assume that the percentage of children born with genetic issues or genetic abnormalities would be, again, following population. However, the ability to of a country to handle, if it's a medical issue, to handle it in country, or the stigma in the country of having a child, or this is the ability of the parents, might vary. So do you see any disproportionate representation for kids with genetic issues coming from different countries?
No, not necessarily. I think part of the problem of saying whether there are more or less in various countries is the population that we see that are actually placed for intercountry adoption. So for instance, in China, it's dependent upon the orphanage director to initiate placement of a child from one of their government institutions. So the orphanage director has to feel that that child might be adopted. If they see a child with a genetic issue that they don't think anyone would accept, they're not going to place that child. So we may not see mm-hmm. that child get into the group of kids that are actually being placed. You know, I would say that genetic abnormalities are pretty common around the world, and I don't think that they're going to vary tremendously by country of origin. But whether or not that country feels that those children are placeable mm-hmm. May vary. So we may see more coming from one country versus the other.
Yeah, that's what I would assume as well. And developmental delays, there are so many reasons for developmental delays, including institutionalization or prenatal exposure. You've already mentioned that alcohol exposure is a significant one. So would we assume that developmental delays would be more common in countries that favor institutional care over foster care?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, mm-hmm. kids in foster care, by and large, look like kids in a family situation anywhere. And so they'll more often be normal than kids who are growing up within institutional care settings.
So of the primary countries that we've talked about, which ones are where are the children institutionalized? China, yes. India, what about India?
I would say that almost all countries other than Korea use institutional care. China does have some programs where children are being cared for within families. They may not be placed there initially, but they may be placed there after a while and really have a good chance of recovering mm-hmm. while they're still in the country of origin. Mm-hmm. But I think that most of the countries that are currently placing are using institutional care.
So we've talked about some of the general impact of children just from malnutrition, environmental toxins, institutionalization, things such as that. But then if we look at international adoption, that itself, the very act of taking a child from everything that they know, turning their life totally topsy-turvy, bringing them to a country where things don't look the same, people don't look the same. They don't talk in a way that they can understand. They don't even smell the same. The smells are different. The food is different. So how does the actual act of taking a child and removing them from anything that's familiar and putting them in a totally different place, how does that impact children?
Well, it can impact them tremendously. So if you look at various ages of children, if you take an infant home from the hospital, they're not going to really care. I mean, they really haven't known that environment, and they're not acclimated to that place. But if you take an infant who's been with their mother for 3 or 4 months and then put them back into a hospital, what'll happen to that infant is that they will be just totally regress and not care about anything. And when they started having pediatric hospitals around the turn of the 20th century, they started noticing this condition where children who had been separated from their mothers and put in the hospital stopped eating, refused to interact, and literally died because they wouldn't take any nourishment. And they termed this hospitalism. And eventually this became known through the work of Bowlby as a very severe form of attachment problem. So children can actually die when separated from the individuals that they know and love and the environment in which they're used to being in. Older children have a different response. They may shut down and regress as well, but they can also have other types of behavior that is much more disruptive. But basically, it's a noxious experience for them to go through that. It's a very stressful experience to be put into a new environment with no one around that you know and no one that you can rely on, and that can have long-term consequences for kids.
What type of behaviors might you see initially and then after a short period of time in children who are trying to cope and adjust with so much change happening all at once?
Well, I do think that just shutting down and not being able to interact or speak or show any emotion at all is a very common one. You know, unfortunately, we're seeing this in the kids in the border that are being separated, you know, where you have kids that cry continually, the kids that won't respond to any kind of interaction just because it's so difficult for them to be separated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Just want to remind everybody that this show is underwritten by the Jockey Being Family Foundation. Jockey Being Family wants you to know that post-permanency adoption support programs are vital to help preserve families. However, the availability of these programs is not always communicated clearly during the adoption process. In fact, often it's not. Legal professionals and judges are essential to encourage the use of these services. As permissible by law, judges, court clerks, and adoption agencies can order backpacks through the Jockey Being Family website to ship to the courthouse for adoption day. To find out how to get your free backpack, please visit jockeybeingfamily.com. Click on their backpack program, and you can get it. Now, your agency generally has to apply, although judges and court clerks can also apply. So thank you, Jockey Being Family, for your support of creating a family. All right. We have talked about, we've circled around talking about institutional care. And as you said earlier, in every country, really with the exception of South Korea, children who are placed in international adoption are in institutional care. Sometimes they're called orphanages. Sometimes they're called child welfare institutions. I should add that the children who are not eligible for international adoption in South Korea are also in child welfare institutions for the most part. But those that are being placed for international adoption are generally in pretty high quality foster care. But other countries, not so much. So let's talk about how institutional care can impact children. And does it vary by age?
It does vary by age. And I think whenever you're looking at potential factors that may damage a child's future, you do have to look at the age and when that occurs. And any child who is very young, who is rapidly growing and developing, dependent on others for care, and where experiences are having a disproportionate effect on development, those are the kids we have to worry about the most. So taking a child as an infant and putting them in an institution for the first 3 years of life is much more devastating than taking a child who is 14 or 15 and putting them in an institutional care settings. Because the older child has much of their growth and development accomplished by that point in time and much of their emotional tone already established. A young child doesn't. And that's where we can see the greatest effects.
Does it affect their physical growth, their emotional growth, their intellectual growth, or all of the above?
It affects everything. In fact, if you look at a vast array of domains in terms of development, which goes from physical development through emotional development, there are very, very few areas that are not affected by institutional care. I always say that institutional care is the three Ps. It's prompt, because it occurs very quickly. It's pervasive because it acts across all domains of development. And the third P is permanent, in which case not all things can be improved by being placed in a family after a child has been in an orphanage.
Yeah, and something else that parents are often not aware of, it's not necessarily just the fact that there may be a low adult to child or caregiver to child ratio or inadequate food or inadequate education or something along those lines. It's also the fact that there's often not enough adult supervision, and it is not uncommon to see abuse amongst the children. And then that's also an issue that parents need to think about.
Yes, that's very true. And in fact, any older child that's adopted out of an institution, I always talk to families about the fact that they have experienced abuse, not only from caregivers, but as you said, from other children. And they've also been exposed, at least exposed to inappropriate sexual situations, or have been sexually abused by, again, the adults taking care of them or by other older children within the institution.
Mm-hmm. So going with your eyes open as parents on help on preparing to integrate that child and help that child. And again, Creating a Family has a number of really excellent courses on parenting and helping a child healed through sexual abuse. Is the impact of institutionalization worse the longer the child is in an orphanage or a child welfare institution?
Yes, it seems to be that way. There have been several very good studies looking at outcome of adoptees who had been institutionalized and then before they joined their adoptive families. And by and large, if kids join their families within the first few months of life, maybe up to 6 months of life, their development is indistinguishable from that of a normal child. Those kids who have been institutionalized for longer than 2 years tend to have more problems, and between 6 months and 24 months is an area where it's variable as to what is affected.
All right. Another impact, both of institutionalization as well as prior abuse or neglect, is attachment issues. And I think it's important to note that attachment issues are along a spectrum. And we hear a lot about RAD, reactive attachment disorder, and that is at one extreme. But there are other varying degrees of attachment issues that we might see in children adopted internationally. So first of all, let's start by saying what children are at the greatest risk for attachment disorders?
Well, kids who are in situations where they're not getting individualized care. You know, human beings can have normal development in a wide variety of environments, but each one of those environments must have a caregiver who is interested in providing the nurture and individual attention that that child needs. Where we see attachment go off the rails is in situations where they don't have individual caregivers who are interested in responding to the individual needs of that particular child. And the example is institutional care, mm-hmm. especially institutional care where we don't have the appropriate number of caregivers. So we're designed for one-to-one, one adult for two children type of caregiving. Mm-hmm. And there are, that allows the caregiver to really be able to respond to what that child needs. When you're dealing with caregivers who have 8, 9, 10 infants to take care of, there's no way besides providing the basics of life that those children are going to get what they need. Mm-hmm. In fact, a number of studies have looked at interaction between children and caregivers in institutional care setting, and the amount of interaction that occurs is incredibly low. A very small percent, single digits of time spent actually interacting with the caregiver. Most of the time, the caregiver is attending to other children or trying to get some rest from all the duties that they have.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And another thing is that there, and depending on the country and, of course, on the institution, there could be high turnover. So you may have a caregiver that has gotten to know a child, but then is either fired or leaves for another job or for whatever reason. So you've got turnover. And so the child is constantly being exposed to new caretaker, even given the fact that they don't have a lot of interaction.
Well, and you know, if you look at a normal situation, you're going to have a handful of caregivers across a year of age for an infant. You know, mom and dad, grandma, a few other relatives, etc. If you look at an institutional care setting that has kind of a normal work schedule, those kids are exposed to 90 to 120 different caregivers over the course of that year. You know, how can any child develop a specific attachment and have consistent caregiving within that kind of an environment?
And that turnover, not turnover, I mean, that setup may well function better for the adults, and that's why they're doing it, you know, work hours, you know, vacation, but it's not good for children.
No, exactly. Certainly isn't.
So what are some of the symptoms of a child with an attachment disorder? And again, knowing that attachment disorders fall along a spectrum. So what should parents look for?
Well, kids with attachment problems will often be colicky babies or have feeding difficulties. They have a hard time gaining weight. You know, I think emotionally and interaction-wise, they're detached and unresponsive. They have a very difficult time being consistently comforted. Older kids will have preoccupied or defiant behaviors, or they won't even want to interact socially with other individuals.
Or even being sometimes indiscriminately affectionate.
Exactly.
Where it doesn't matter who it is, a survival technique for them has been to quickly ingratiate themselves into any of the adults that walk in a room. And that survival technique carries on. So you might see that type of behavior in a child.
Right, exactly. Disinhibited social engagement disorder, as it's called now, is a very interesting phenomenon because it's very compelling for parents. They see their child who's very, very friendly and always wants to go make friends with other people in the room. And I remember seeing a set of brothers who were adopted by a family who brought the younger one to me because they were disengaged and they thought that child had a problem, which he did. But the other child was equally dysfunctional in terms of attachment, was going around and being friendly with everyone. And they thought that child was absolutely normal.
Yeah, exactly. So what is the and this is a you could take an entire class in graduate school on this. So, and I'm not asking for that level of detail. But what is the general process of developing attachment and emotional ties for children when they come into their adoptive family?
Right. Well, you know, parents often ask me, you know, will my child have an attachment disorder? And I'll say, of course they will. You know, they've grown up in an orphanage where they have no chance to attach at all. So they have really no meaningful attachment behavior. So what your job is to do is to go back and look at what the attachment cycle is. So your child has a need. Your child cries out or otherwise has some behavior that says that they have a need. You go in and you feed them, you change their diapers, you kiss their boo-boo, whatever. And that child develops a feeling of comfort and security that the world is a good place. And this happens when you think of an infant tens of thousands of times that first year of life. And it reinforces the idea that the world is a good place and that there are people around that are interested in you and that you can make your needs be known and have them met. So a family adopting a child who has not had this type of environment has to look for cues to respond to. They have to look for things their kids need. They have to make a big deal about this, and they have to do it repeatedly and over a long period of time until that attachment cycle sinks in to that child. And it takes a while, but I would say that, you know, we did a survey of 1,700 families with 3,000 kids that were adopted internationally. And most families say that within a short period of time, they felt attached to their kids. So this is an issue. Parents need to pay attention to it. But with the exception of a few children who have severe problems, attachment comes along if parents are responsive to their child's needs.
Mm-hmm. We tell people, slow down, simplify your life, and just be. Just be with the child, respond to their needs, notice them, and children generally will develop an attachment. But the one question we will often get, and this one drives me a little nuts, a family will contact, we have a large support group, and they will post and say, you know, we've been home for 3 weeks. I think my child has reactive attachment disorder, you know, because they don't come to me when they need things or they don't like to be hugged or whatever. So how long post-adoption should you wait until you begin to truly worry about a full-blown attachment disorder versus a child who is learning to attach?
Right. Well, you know, attachment is a two-way street. So you have to have the child attached to you, but you also have to have yourself attached to the child. So I think if people feel that there are difficulties, and I wouldn't look at 3 weeks as a time period where I would expect wonderful attachment to occur. You know, if you're out 2 or 3 months and you're concerned about that, then it's time to see a mental health professional who is expert in looking at attachment behavior and seeing whether it's an issue of the child or an issue of the parents. Because both can be factors.
Yeah, that's exactly. I'm so glad you said we often will say attachment is a two-way street, and parents feel great shame if they are the ones who are not feeling a bond or an attachment to their child. But that could absolutely be part of the problems. And the good news is that with work and with a dedicated therapist who understands attachment and adoption, you can get past this. But I'm really glad you pointed that out.
Exactly. You know, it's some of it is just not intuitive. I mean, you people really need to have expert help in how to do this the right way. And luckily, you know, we have mental health professionals that see all of our patients the first time, and they assess, you know, briefly looking at the parent's ability to understand cues from their child and the child's ability to give cues to their parents. And if that's not happening, you know, there can be advice given at the even initially, very shortly after arrival, on how to improve.
Yeah, excellent. And let me also mention that, as I said before, Creating a Family does have many courses on attachment, how to help establish attachment, working within the first 6 months to create attachment, attaching to different ages of child, parental attachment. We have a lot of different courses for families to access. Also, let me remind you that this show is brought to you not only through our underwriting through the Jockey Being Family Foundation, but also our partner agencies. And our partner agencies are those that believe in our mission of providing unbiased, accurate information, both pre and post adoption. And they not only believe it, but they're putting their money behind it into support of this show. And this show truly, well, this show as well as all the resources we provide, would not happen without their support. Let me tell you about two of them. One is Children's House International, and they have some very exciting news. They have been chosen by the CCCWA, but that is the responsible authority in China, so it's the China Adoption Authority, to participate in a new program that will allow home study ready families, so you do have to have a home study, to travel to China to meet the child they are matched with. And meeting your child and getting a better idea of what their particular needs are will hopefully decrease adoption dissolutions or struggles post-permanency, post-placement. To get more information, you can go to their website at Children's House International. And we also have Children's Connection. They are an adoption agency providing services for domestic infant adoption, embryo donation and adoption throughout the United States, as well as home studies and post-adoption support to families in Texas. All right, now we've talked about the abuse and neglect and trauma that children face just from the act of being institutionalized. And some children come into state care because of abuse or neglect. And neglect is often a symptom of poverty. So we know that, and then once in the institution, we've talked a great deal about how neglect or certainly a lack of attention is common. And then it's possible to have abuse, and just the act of being placed in an institution is traumatic. So I wanted to talk a bit about some of the psychological issues children may face who have experienced abuse, neglect, or trauma.
Well, there are a wide variety of things that can happen to kids, depending on the situation that they are in. Certainly children who have experienced specific physical or sexual abuse in their family of origin are going to be very reactive to those type of situations when they get into their foster family or to their adoptive family. And those are the kids who we see with clear post-traumatic stress disorder when they're in situations that remind them of where they had been before. Those children require a lot of understanding from their adoptive parents And especially children who have been sexually abused need to start out immediately in a therapeutic situation with their adopted family to try and work through these issues. I've seen a lot of kids who have been traumatized, but no child has been more traumatized than kids who have experienced sexual abuse. It really is a horrible situation for them to go through. And there is no family they can get through this by themselves without professional assistance. The kids that have been neglected actually may have more emotional and behavioral problems simply because of the fact that they have not had any stimulation at all in their environments. So they're the kids that we see with anxiety, with depression. These are the kids who appear to have attention problems because they're always looking for what's happened to them in the past. And it can be very, very difficult for families who are not aware of these kinds of things, who are not in a therapeutic situation, to be able to parent these kids effectively. So I always tell families who are adopting kids out of these particular situations that they really need to establish a therapeutic relationship with a knowledgeable individual before they bring the child into the family, and then continue that afterwards, not only for the child's benefit, but also to support themselves, because it's a difficult time taking care of these kids.
Exactly. And the time to do that, and just to reiterate what you just said, is before you bring the child home. And finding a therapist that is adoption competent, your agency can help you find such a therapist, and that could be your placing agency or your home study agency. Sometimes if your placing agency is located somewhere else, your home study agency may be in a better situation to help you find such a person. And I was glad you brought up PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What are some of the symptoms that parents would look for a child who is experiencing PTSD so that they know to get help sooner rather than later?
Well, it sometimes depends on the age of the child. You know, if it happens very, very early for a child, they may not have explicit memories of what happened to them, but they may have subcortical synapses that will remind them emotionally of kind of what happened. So they may break down in situations where it doesn't make a lot of sense to the adoptive parents as to what might be going on. Other kids may have much more explicit memories of things and may respond to things like we would normally expect, you know, when they're afraid someone's going to hit them, or when they are in a situation where they've been previously abused. Those are the kinds of things that parents need to look for. Okay. And I think that, you know, knowing as much as you can about the background of the child and where that child has been and the experiences that they've had will help you really understand why children respond the way they do when they get into specific situations.
And it can be pre-memory, and that's it, or post-memory, but the child has blocked it out.
Right.
So you can look at their symptoms and see if they're responding in a way that seems not appropriate for the stimulus, that they're over-responding or under-responding, and that would be something, yes, to pay attention on.
Exactly.
All right. Something that when parents are adopting internationally, we mentioned at the beginning, is they need to understand the laws and the adoption process of the their child's country of origin, and understand what delays may be happening or anything that might hinder the finalization of the adoption. The best place to get information on the country-specific laws and the adoption process, first, is your agency. And second would be the U.S. State Department website on intercountry adoption. And they have a country information section. Again, that is travel.state.gov. And you go there and you click on country-specific information, and you would then go to the country that you're interested in. And if you forget travel.state.gov, just search for State Department International Adoption, and it will take you there. And also note that each year, the State Department is required to do an annual report on intercountry adoption, and it includes length of time it took to complete an adoption in the last year from specific countries. And it also includes some cost information. And to get to find out about that, you can go to the country-specific pages at, let's say it again, travel.state.gov to get that information. All right. So we know that children coming to the U.S., we've talked about it, that they are coming from, that everything is totally new. It's also, it just seems like it's really important to understand that they're also coming from a different culture, both the culture of the country, as well as the culture of perhaps their, if they were fortunate to be in a foster family, or the culture of the institution. So what are some of the acculturation or assimilation issues children may face once here in the United States?
When you look at it, where children are coming from, almost every family who adopts internationally are going to become a multiracial and a multicultural family. So believing that you are going to maintain your family as it was before, you're white, you're Swedish, and in the case of my family, is just not going to be the case. Suddenly, we have a brown boy in the family, and the brown boy is from India. And that child needs to know that they are a valid, important, worthwhile individual, and the place that they came from is a wonderful place filled with people just like him, who are also wonderful people with interesting culture, interesting foods, and a place to be proud of. I have unfortunately run into families who have a very negative impression of the country that the child is from, or have members of the family who aren't particularly happy that it's now a multiracial family. And people, and that's unfortunate for the child because that's going to impact their self-esteem later on in life. So I think it's very, very important for families to integrate their family life as much as possible into the culture and into the racial balance that that child is from.
I agree wholeheartedly. And not only is the family and extended family adjusting, but the child, depending on the age of the child, him or herself is adjusting. You know, they've come from a place where everyone looked like them and behaved like them because there were certain cultural things that were the norm where they were at. And so the child also is having to adjust to the fact that all of a sudden people don't look the same. They obviously are going to be talking different, but they, you know, even a child old enough to have had any religious practice would be experiencing differences in religious culture as well. So all of that are issues that, that the family has to adjust to, but the child is also having to adjust. How does age or the temperament of the child impact how quickly they assimilate? And then are there certain ages where the child simply is going to always feel as if they have immigrated, which of course they have, to and not fully a part of this culture?
Well, I think, you know, as children get older and more used to the culture that they grow up in, that can be more problematic when they come to a different country. We've had many families who have adopted older children where the children initially at least were not very happy that they were taken away from their country of origin and people that they felt very, very comfortable with. You know, there are some care environments where children really do feel that they have been part of a family there, and separating them from that family is going to bring a period of time where they're going to be very uncomfortable with their new surroundings. People can get over that, but I think that families have to be very sensitive to that fact. As you mentioned, it's going to be very different over here. I remember when my son was very, very young, I was just astonished at how, you know, and this was just months of age, how differently he reacted to an individual with dark skin as versus white skin, because he clearly recognized that those are the people that look like him. So it's very important to recognize that the kids are going to feel a little discombobulated when they arrive here.
And for parents, what they need, if you are adopting transracially or transculturally, You have to be prepared ahead of time to become a transracial family. And that means learning things that you need to do to help your child grow into, to grow to an adult of the race that they are. And we want our kids to have a healthy, strong identity as an African woman in the United States, or as an Indian man, or as an Asian girl or young woman in the U.S. So there are definitely things that parents can do both before, but also after their child is here. And it will be outside the purviews of this course, but creating a family has a lot of courses on becoming a transracial, transcultural family through international adoption. And we have handouts, we've got tip sheets, things that you can do as parents, both before the adoption and after the adoption, to help your child and help your family both. So something to be planning on beforehand.
Well, I think that's an extremely important point, Dawn. And I was pretty naive when I adopted Gabriel. And I came to realize that there are things that individuals of color need to do in our society in order to survive. And especially mm-hmm. if you're a young, muscular teenager or mm-hmm. Young male. It's things not only that make life better, but it actually will save your child's life mm-hmm. if you know what to teach them.
Yeah, and I hear you and completely agree about the male part, but I would also say that girls coming into this country.
Absolutely.
I know you were not saying that girls, but I mean, there are things that from a Black woman's perspective or from an Asian woman's perspective that is simply different in our culture. And parents, and it's interesting because those of, and I am white and you are white, and those of us who have grown up, who are white and have grown up in this culture, are often simply not aware of it because number one, we haven't faced it. And number two, you know, we talk about white privilege, but it's real that we don't see and notice things because we don't have to because it hasn't affected us.
Exactly.
Our children will be impacted by it. And the other thing I always tell parents is that when your children are little, they're a part of you. They're a part.
Yes.
They're under your umbrella. And we don't really go that far outside of our community. So people get to know us, people in the grocery store. After a while, we're no longer, as a transracial family, we no longer stand out. But that changes when your child is not under your umbrella. Your child will be viewed as an Indian man or as a Black woman or as an Asian college student. And it's our job to prepare them to be an Asian, Black, or Indian person in this country. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. And now we're coming to a topic that is it's one I feel so passionately about. And it's the whole idea of post-adoption or post-placement reports. They are very often required. Again, you can go to the State Department site, statetravel.state.gov, and find out exactly what the country from your child's country is going to require. But it's become a big problem in international adoption with families not completing their post-adoption reports as required. And the problem is for the family, but it's also for the future of all international adoption. And because there are countries that are shutting down because they have not received these reports. And I would go so far as that you have a moral obligation. You have agreed prior to the adoption to fill out these reports. And even if for whatever reason you're irritated with your agency or you're really busy and you just don't have the time, you need to make the time. So I will get off my soapbox here, but you can get information about exactly what is required from your agency, of course, or at the State Department website, travel.state.gov. Click on international adoption or intercountry adoption, and then click on country information. All right. So now we've talked about, it feels like, a lot of the negatives of all the problems kids might have. But let's talk about some of, and this is, you guys are certainly in, at University of Minnesota, is certainly on the forefront of doing a lot of this research. So how do kids who are adopted internationally fare once they are brought here and are raised in a hopefully well-prepared U.S. family?
Well, I continue to be in this business and have a great deal of enthusiasm about it because what I do see is the is kids coming in and are transformed by their adoptive families into individuals with self-esteem, great capacity, and able to function well within adult society. You know, there are exceptions, and, you know, we can't fix everything. Not all the sequelae of institutional care can go away. Certainly, we see effects of alcohol over the long term. But by and large, the vast majority of families are very happy that they adopted, and their children are doing well.
I think that's really important to remember. The act of adoption in and of itself can function as a healing factor from a lot that children have experienced. And that happens better when parents are well prepared in advance.
Exactly.
Yeah. And adoption itself does have lifelong impacts on children, just the act of adoption. It's not oftentimes not negative nor positive, but it does impact children, adolescents, and even into adults. Let me recommend two resources. One is a book by Dr. David Brodzinski. He used to be on our board. He is wonderful. And the book is Being Adopted, The Lifelong Search for Self. It was actually co-authored by Dr. Brodzinski. That's a wonderful book that talks about the lifelong impact of adoption. Another one that you might want to consider is The Primal Wound by Nancy Verrier. And those are good resources. You can also find, or you can just type in, search for The Primal Wound, and you can read articles on it if you would like. And as well, I should also add that Creating a Family has courses as well as free resources on the lifelong impact on development from the effect of being adopted. So I would recommend that you consider and go there. Well, any other positive or negative things that you would like to sum us up on, Dr. Johnson?
Well, all I would say is that when I came into the field of adoption, I didn't appreciate how important families were. You know, and I'm a pediatrician. You know, I know that kids are supposed to be in families, and that's a good thing, and blah, blah, blah. But I didn't understand how devastating it was for kids to develop in an environment that didn't include a family until I went into a Romanian orphanage and saw the kids. It's enormous benefit for a child to grow up in a family. It changes everything in that child's life. And I look back on my own life and my parents and what they gave me, and I'm just amazed at the gift that a family is for a child. And I strongly encourage families who are interested in adopting to pursue it, because I think the outcome is such a wonderful situation in most cases.
Well, thank you. It's a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much, Dr. Dana Johnson, professor of pediatrics and the founder of, or one of the founders of, the Adoption Medicine Clinic at the University of Minnesota. The views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. And keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your adoption professional. Thank you, everyone, and we will see you next week.